The name of this session is Designer Jeans, and we're going to be looking at some of the issues related to genetic engineering and reproductive technologies. Some people think, that genetic engineering is a rather esoteric topic, one that not everybody has a vested interest in. And so what I want to do before I start talking about it is to lay out a couple of sort of case study kinds of things, incidents really. And I want you to think about those while I'm talking. And then we're going to come back and talk about one or more of the case studies. It seems to me that we're being confronted by some brand new options, things that we have never, ever had to deal with before. In the past, when you talked about dealing with genetic issues, essentially what you were talking about was coping with what the genetic reproductive dice dealt you. I mean, there weren't a whole lot of choices there. I mean, there were some very basic techniques that we've used for genetic engineering, and some that we have sort of internalized within our culture. The deep-seated taboo on marrying first cousins, and particular brothers and sisters, is a rudimentary form of genetic engineering. People sort of realizing what happens when that happens, when close genetic folks intermarry. But for the most part, when we talk about genetic engineering, there really wasn't any. We just tried to deal with what came out of rather haphazard unions. So let me give you a couple of incidents to get you thinking kind of in the general area that we're talking about. And here's a good point, I guess, just to give you a little bibliography. The single best book that I have found in this area and in the general area of biomedical engineering is this book, Human Medicine, Ethical Perspectives on Today's Medical Issues by James B. Nelson and Joanne Smith Rorish, I guess is how you pronounce her name. I put it up there on the board, Human Medicine, Nelson and Rorish. The bookstore was asked to have it available, and they tried, but I've got the revised expanded edition, and evidently they're in the middle of a new revised expanded edition. Because it's such a good book, I'm sure it's being updated for use in courses in college level. So I suspect that's probably what's happening, but that means it's not available for us right now. So I want to draw a couple of cases that that he lifts out. The first one is under the topic of genetics and the control of human development. Jennifer met her husband over the noon hour to discuss the important information she had just received. Her face was troubled. Guiding her to a quiet table, Jack asked her anxiously, "Well, what did you find out? Is the baby okay?" "Yes, I mean, no," she blurted out, her disappointment and frustration overflowing with her tears. Dr. Martin said the amniocentesis results were certain. "You know how much we wanted a boy, Jack. I don't want a fourth girl. I don't. I think I want an abortion." A couple contacted a genetic counselor. They had a daughter of 20, two sons in their teens, and twins age 5. The twins were born afflicted with microcephaly, which means that their heads were about two-thirds of the size of normal. Both were born blind. One was deaf. The other had a rare and difficult blood disorder, and both were prone to epileptic seizures. At age 5, one of the twins continued to cry from 16 to 18 hours a day and weighed only 17 pounds. The parents, devout and conservative Roman Catholics, indicated that their daughter was about to become engaged. If she married and had children, they asked, would this strike again? Third case. According to some scientists, it should soon be possible to develop people designed to perform certain tasks more efficiently. For example, three-armed people might be produced to perform certain industrial tasks. They could be fed by four-legged chickens with two extra drumsticks, which were actually produced in 1981. Flannery O'Connor has a famous quotation about that, that she felt like a four-legged chicken. If it becomes possible to do such things, should we? What moral arguments could be raised to counter such proposals? And let me give you one more sort of blob of questions, and then we'll move in to talking about it. When bad timing faded as the probable cause for their failure to conceive, Evelyn sought medical counsel. The gynecologist saw no impediment. Harry, slow to believe that he might be the source of the problem, ain't that just like a guy, finally went to a specialist who soon diagnosed a very low sperm count. He was effectively sterile. With the extremely long wait for adoptable infants and with Evelyn's strong desire to experience pregnancy and childbirth, they began to talk about artificial insemination with sperm from an anonymous donor. And yet Harry honestly wondered if he would always feel differently toward the child than his wife would. Well, we have always struggled with how we can have the kinds of children, offspring that we would like. Most of the time, we haven't been able to do a whole lot about that. But a couple of developments within the last, 20, 25 years have raised these issues with a certain new urgency that we've never had to deal with them before. The first thing would be the breakthroughs by Crick and Watson in simply understanding the biochemistry of how genetic information is passed on. We have 23 chromosomes, somewhere around 150,000 genes, and about 3 billion base coding blocks that pass on the data. And after the work of Crick and Watts, we began to understand at least the basic physiology of how those things were passed on. Based on that, we moved into the next area with recombinant genetic engineering, which is to say taking out one gene and plugging in another one. We haven't been able to do that with particularly sophisticated, certainly not whole organisms, but we have effectively been able to transform certain small organisms into little insulin factories. So if you are a diabetic, you know that you used to have to depend on sheep and other animals giving up their lives for you. Well, we don't have that anymore. Most of the insulin on the market, except for a very rare group of people who have to deal with immune reactions to artificially synthesized, well, not actually artificially, but genetically synthesized insulin. Now we have an industrial product here that's insulin. We do the same thing with human growth hormone. That's not nearly as major an affliction simply because of the distribution of it within the population, but for those who were suffering from a lack of it, it was a pretty major breakthrough. So come on in. And the technology has continued to become more and more sophisticated. And the sort of the push culminated in 1990 with something called the Human Genome Project. How many people here are familiar with the Human Genome Project? Have you even heard of it? Okay. What is it? Can you say what it is in 25 words or less?
I think it was sponsored by the U.S. government. You'll have to correct me.
No, I'm not trying to catch you.
Where they were going to try to uncover, decipher the DNA sequences.
Right, exactly. It's what some people call the biological equivalent of the moonshot. It's the desire, massive infusions of money. In 1993, it was up to $200 million a year. And depending on your perspective, some biologists at our school call this the great biological pork barrel. Others think it's the greatest project to come down the pipe. But basically, its intention is to try to sequence and map all of the human genome. That is to take all 23 chromosomes and to map out where you will find any given trait. Now, there's some discussion as to whether you'll be able to do that or not, but that's the goal. So that we could say on chromosome 15 at this point, I'm picking up the numbers. Any of you who are biologists, if I hit the wrong chromosome or something, please don't hold me accountable. But basically something like here on chromosome 15, midway down, is the one that affects the size of your elbow or something. Or here over here is the chromosome that affects whether one has diabetes or not. Actually, we know where that one is, and then we're in the process of working on that. But the goal, of course, is to figure out where any given genetic trait is. And then, given the technologies that we've already got in place and are improving all along, to be able to make changes in there so that we can do some genetic screening. We go through, we say, we want to make sure that nobody passes on the trait for Huntington's chorea, for example, degenerative brain disease that's excruciatingly painful, invariably fatal, and for which there is no known cure or treatment. So we discover where this is, we run the screening process through, and then what do we do? And we're going to come back to some of the issues. What would we do if we had the technology to do the screening? The other trend that's happened that sort of raised the genetic engineering issues to a new urgency is the whole development of in vitro fertilization techniques. The capability of bypassing mother, father, the goal, and hypothetically some of the people at our university are already talking about this, that at some point there will be technologically no reason why you will have to have a womb, a biological womb. We can take an egg from over here and a sperm from over here, we'll put it into this apparatus. And of course, at this point, we're talking, most of that kind of research is being done in agricultural applications. But, and I think this is the key thing to understand, the essential technology is not any different, whether you're talking about a pig, a cow, or a human. As someone pointed out, the vast majority of our genetic material we share with other animals, and particularly with other mammals. And so the technology really doesn't care how we use it. And you remember we talked about this a little bit at the first session, about how we understand technology. And the technology itself is neutral. And it really doesn't care whether we are trying to eliminate Huntington's chorea or trying to create the super race. And those are the two ends of the ethical spectrum that you'll hear people talking about. This is the greatest thing to alleviate human suffering in the history of mankind. This is the greatest threat to the dignity of humanity to ever come down the pike. Because for the first time, we have the capability to fundamentally change our biological structure. We've never had the capability to do that again. We can change what it means to be biologically a human being. Now, there are a lot of people who are concerned about this, and a lot of different interests for different reasons. Insurance companies are concerned. public policy analysts are concerned, doctors are concerned, anybody who ever has had or plans to have a child, really anybody who has genetic makeup ought to be concerned about this. But there's a special set of concerns that I think we as people of faith need to bring to the table. Everybody will be engaged in this debate to one degree or another. We may be actively engaged, we may be ill-informed engaged, but we will have to deal with this. And what I would like to hold up to you is that it's important for us as people of faith to reflect on our own tradition and then respond to the challenges, not kind of on a generic set of values, but on those things that specifically draw from our own religious tradition. In other words, asking, because I am a person of faith, or maybe because I am a Christian, what does that seem to say is important for me to consider as we wrestle with these issues? And so what I want to lay out for you real quickly are some areas that I think are important for us to consider, you know, five basic categories. And then after I've done that, we're going to have some conversation. We can go with the case studies that I laid out before you, or we can do something else if you would prefer. But I want to at least talk about these basic categories. It seems to me the first area that we might think in terms of is, what do we mean when we think about creation? I think one of the problems that we have sometimes had, and certainly this was the problem that a lot of Christians had in the 19th century when Darwin knocked their socks off, was to think that creation is essentially something that God went, it's done, it's finished, been there, done that, God's finished, he's gone on vacation, whatever God does after God finishes doing God's thing. And yet, what we, I think, need to understand is that from the very beginning, the church has had a very clear understanding that creation is not a static, one time, it's been done, it's over kind of understanding, but rather that creation is an ongoing process, that God is continually creating the world into being. The idea that if God speaks, I mean, or when God speaks, things come into existence. And if God were ever to cease speaking, as it were, if God were to take away God's hands, then the creation collapses back into itself, a great chaos. It seems to me that's very important for us to understand, because what it suggests is that we don't have to be afraid on theological grounds that something is going to change with our genes. From the very beginning, we have understood that creation is an ongoing, vibrant kind of process. And more specifically, that humanity has a place in the created order. That one of the ways that God creates, you see, is through human ingenuity. That God does a new thing, not just, I mean, I think that would be impressive, that God brings something into existence, kind of abracadabra, like a magician pulling a rabbit out of a hat. But it's even much, much more impressive, much more amazing that God uses us to do the new things. And we Lutherans are constantly talking in our sacramental theology about how God works through means. Well, God works through means in the created order. Phil Hefner in Chicago, the Chicago Seminary, has done a lot of work in the area of faith science and technology. And one of the concepts that he's come up with is the idea of humanity as the created co-creators. You see, the idea we are created, and yet part of what we are created for is to be engaged in the process of new creation, to glorify God Now, one can get all finicky about exactly whether what we do is creation. You know, God creates ex nihilo, out of nothing. We don't really create out of nothing. But yet, I think you see the point that I'm trying to move at here. Now, another thing in our doctrine of creation, and I think this is very, very important, is that the doctrine of creation says there is intentionality to the way that things are created. That when God creates things, it's not a cosmic crapshoot. As someone who's radically into a material understanding of the universe, who would say, evolution is simply blind chance. The doctrine of creation says, well, not so fast. We as Christians believe evolution is a process. It is the means by which we understand things. But it's not ultimately a cosmic crapshoot, that God is taking it somewhere. There is a purpose. And when God does something, it's going somewhere. There's an intentionality to it. Now, what that suggests to me is, if we're going to begin monkeying around with genetic engineering, we need to be pretty clear about our own intentionality. To what end are we trying to do these things? We may have very good reasons to do that. But before we move into the area of making radical changes in the human genome, we best consider to what end we are doing this. For what purpose are we undertaking these kinds of radical transformations in the human makeup? Now, the other thing that I think that we get out of the doctrine of creation is that when God creates, he puts humanity into the garden and says, take care of this place. Unfortunately, we have lost that in the history of the church, particularly when it comes to the area of technology. We have not fully appreciated the fact that part of the doctrine of creation is the responsibility to care for the creation. But I think we're beginning to get that back, much just because we see what we've done to the creation. But what we need to be considering, it seems to me, as we think about genetic engineering, is will this enable us to more carefully, more effectively care for the earth? The other thing that I think is very important to deal with here is that God puts humanity in the garden, and what does he tell them to do? He says, till it. Make some changes. Use it. It's okay to alter it. Use the knowledge, but use it responsibly. In areas of faith, science, and technology, it seems we constantly fight on two fronts. On one hand, you fight the techno-romantics, who are opposed to technology and human intervention in any form. And on the other hand, you fight the techno-messianics, who believe that we've always got a technological solution to every problem. The doctrine of creation fights both of those tendencies. It says, yes, we are called to be in the process of creation. This is a good creation. It's here for our use, but let's be responsible in using it. Now, the second area that I want to talk a little bit about is the area of sin. Sin is traditionally been defined as that which separates humanity from God. That's good. You know, that's what we say when we're thinking and being real theologically specific. More often than not, it tends to get a rather moralistic tone to it. But one of the fascinating implications that's coming out of the Human Genome Project, or genetic engineering in general, is that we're beginning to come up against the fact that a lot of things that we have thought were about human culpability, about bad choices, about us doing the wrong thing and being disobedient, are not about that at all, but are about biology and about things that we may or may not be able to control. Now, there are things that nobody would argue are problematic. For example, alcoholism, which more and more we are finding has a very strong genetic predisposition. That is, that there are some people who can drink like a fish and never become alcoholic, and there are others who take one sip of wine and are already gone. You know, that there's a very strong genetic predisposition in those cases. So we have those situations that nobody would argue with. Then there's another area, and I guess the best example of this would be homosexuality, where there is tremendous debate within the church community as to whether this is more akin to alcoholism or brown eyes, if you see what I mean. A problem or simply a trait that is passed on genetically. But then again, we're finding has strong genetic predisposition or perhaps determinancy depending on which literature you're reading. But the point of all of this is that has the potential to radically alter our understanding of sin. You know, if something is beyond our control, does it make any sense to talk about that as sinful? And we are going, you see, the more we get into this, the more we're going to have to be reconsidering those categories of things that we understand as sinful. Even the whole idea of human culpability, responsibility for certain behaviors is going to come under renewed scrutiny. Because we say, well, how does one hold one accountable for something that's genetically determined? And so that's what I mean by culpability and responsibility. The other thing is, the essence of sin is a recognition of human limitations. And it seems to me that what we as Christians can bring to the table as we begin to talk about genetic engineering is a very realistic, rather than an abstractionist, point of view when it comes to these technologies. We say, in essence, maybe there's nothing wrong in theory with genetic engineering, but we are wise enough, realistic enough to say that human beings are eminently imperfect. We have a tremendous capacity for self-delusion, for oppression, for ignorance. Even if there's no malevolence, simply that we are not capable of making all the decisions. Now, the genetic process has been sifting and culling in one form or another, you know, for thousands and thousands of years. Do we dare say, well, we have got it figured out and we're going to make this radical change based on our knowledge, which may or may not be as comprehensive as we think it is? So it seems to be part of what comes out of reflecting on our doctrine of sin and being realistic about who we are has got to be a certain holy humility as we undertake these kinds of enterprises. A recognition that we may not know what is best as we go down the pike. There's a lot of concern at our university, and I'm sure at any university that's doing much agricultural research, that And let me take an excursus here. The place where genetic engineering is far and away the furthest developed, of course, is in agriculture, and particularly, you know, in developing plant strains. You know, we've been doing this either formally or informally for as long as we've had agriculture. We take the ones with the big stalks and the ones that had the big ears, and we put those together, and we pull up the little ones. That's genetic. But one of the real concerns that the people at our university have is that we have a few strains of wheat, corn, you take the crop, that are really productive. And so we crossbreed those suckers back and forth again and again and again until we slowly lose certain other strains. which may not be very adapted for our place at this point. Maybe we don't need those strains very much in Iowa with X number of inches of topsoil and this amount of water and this amount of resistance to disease, because we haven't seen that disease forever. But what happens if an environment changes? You know, the genetic buildup is kind of like a bank account. You know, you may not need all of it, but if this particular venture goes bust, you want to be able to go back and pull out the old genetic stuff and start over again. There's a real concern that we're losing that. Well, we can take the case to the human level. Suppose we breed out, and that's basically what we're going to be talking about, breeding out certain characteristics that don't seem very adaptable right now. But suppose we need those later on. Maybe the best example that we've already begun to see is this one. Sickle cell anemia, a disease that afflicts almost, it may be totally, but certainly predominantly black persons. Nasty disease in the context of North America. Most people would say we need to breed that sucker out as quickly as we can. And yet, what folks have discovered is in equatorial Africa, people with sickle cell anemia are much, much less likely to develop malaria. And suddenly we begin to understand that was an ace in the hole. Malaria, you know, sickle cell anemia is nasty, but malaria is worse. And so there was an adaptive power there. Now, we don't know what else is out there. Maybe there is some adaptive purpose to some things that on its face we would quickly want to get rid of. We just don't know at this point. And again, you see, we're talking about single genetic variables. There's always the possibility that this variable doesn't do much of anything by itself, but you put it with this one over here and something rather dramatic takes place. So all this is to say we need to be realistic about ourselves, about our capabilities, rather than obstructionist. Now, another thing that's going to happen is we're going to have to wrestle with what do we mean by what it means to be human. And I feel, you know, and just think for just a second here. I'll just kind of pause. What does it mean to be human? How would you define that if someone asked you? There's one whole school that would say that's a very simple question, Pastor King. Being human means you've got 23 chromosomes that are made up in the configuration of Homo sapien. Very simple question. We don't need to go any further than that. And basically, that is the school that undergirds most Roman Catholic and evangelical social thought. You know, we don't have to get into real complicated questions. If it's got the right requisite chromosomes, then it's human. On the other end of the scale are folks who would fall into what's called the social consequences school. And they would say there is no out there kind of given, and certainly not a genetic given, of what it means to be human. To be human, as opposed to being a member of a biological species, is a social construct. We, as the adult members of a society, have a right to determine what it means to be human. And so, you see, we can decide that if somebody doesn't meet this criteria, then they're not really human. Now, that, I don't know about you, that kind of sends chills up my spine, because then we say, well, if you're not smart enough or able enough, then you cease to be human. But these folks really think that they are being realistic about the human enterprise, that we just really cannot afford to be soft-headed about this. And then somewhere in between is somebody who would say to be human is a developmental kind of thing, that it's a combination of biological givens and some social things that we work together to decide what it means to be human. And maybe you can see this Let me pose the question or make an observation. We always have a funeral for a stillbirth, but we very seldom have a funeral for a miscarriage. Now, genetically, those two things are identical. And yet, viscerally, we understand something different about those two things. We may have a funeral in the context of a miscarriage for the family, but for the most part, there's something within us that knows there's a difference there, that one deserves more sacredness, that we do ritual for that. Well, I think that is what the developmental folks are saying. What it means to be human is going to differ, you know, and it varies on some social scales. Well, Christians have traditionally said that dignity is based on what God says. You know, that God imputes dignity to us. It's not that we value another person that makes them human. It's the fact that God has said, this is mine. I call it human. But what's not real clear is whether God has said that because of the inherent vitality of that, because he simply has life, or because it has the potential. Now, all of that is to get to this point, and maybe it was too long to get there. Is there a genetic cutoff? Can life be given more meaning or more dignity by our efforts? And I'll just pull that off. You see, that's the sort of the crux of the matter. If we believe that it can be, then we do everything we can to make a life better. But the converse is also true. That means that some life is not as valuable as others. And do we really want to go to that point? Do we want to say that some life is more valuable than others? Which is to say, what degree will we remake humanity and by what standards? And you see, and that's the point. If we're going to do genetic engineering, we've got to decide we want certain characteristics and we don't want others. And who's going to make that decision? What are the characteristics that we want to control for? Some of them seem to be no-brainers. We don't want Huntington's chorea. We don't want Down syndrome. But do we want tall people as opposed to short people? Do we want to control for obesity? Okay. Well, you see, and that's a very interesting thing. You know, some people would say that it is not long-term adaptable to be skinny. You know, that we are designed to have a little extra fat, and the only problem is not genetic, but environmental. You know, that the crux of our dilemma, healthcare-wise, is that our genes are just fine. It's that we're not doing what we were genetically programmed to do. You see, how about intelligence? Is that what we want to program for? Do we really want a group of people who are brilliant and would therefore be bored to tears with mundane tasks in the society? What are the things that we want to control for? And then you see you begin to get into the idea that we're not real sure what we mean by the good society. Even if we could do it, would we really want to do it?
Then who pulls the trigger? Who makes that decision?
Right.
Government?
Well, and of course, that's the question. That's the question. Who makes the determination of whether we do this attribute or another? And again, to go back to the idea, we may not even know what's in the best interest of the society. You see? And I think that's something that we really need to be deeply reflective on. Because, you see, it lifts up the idea that the problem is not technological. The problem is value. We don't know what we value in a society and in an individual. Now, Let me quickly talk about a couple more attributes, and then, oh boy, we're about out of time. Okay. Let me just lay that out there. Community concerns. For Christians and for religious folks, community has always been a very important thing. And how will the capacity to change genetic makeup affect our sense of mutual care? Remember, I said for most of human history, the idea of dealing with genetic issues has been simply a matter of coping. Someone has a child that's not all the way that they would like for it to be. We feel compassion for them. We rally around them. But what happens when, doggone it, they could have gone through some genetic screening? They knew darn well that they were likely to produce a Down syndrome child. They had the potential for amniocentesis. They didn't take it. Why should I have to pay for the special education of that kid? And suddenly we got a whole nother set of issues that we're perfectly willing to cope with things that we think are inevitable. But suddenly when we have the option, how is that going to affect the way we understand compassion? And, you know, I picked that particular example, but, you know, we could take a variety of other ones. You know, why didn't they screen for progressive heart disease? We're rapidly beginning to believe that that is a major variable. You know, will we continue to care for the weakest in our society? Put it a different way, will the capacity, and here's what I'm trying to say here, will the capacity to make changes suddenly become the duty to make those changes? Suppose that for some reason I don't really believe I ought to be monkeying around with my genes and choose to have children the old-fashioned way, taking the luck of the draw, as it were. What happens to my society, to my status in the society? What it's coming down to, you see, is how do we balance individual and social goods? Maybe what is good for me is not going to be good for the society at whole, as a whole. And that, of course, really gets more into, I think, the issue of in vitro fertilization. Maybe society doesn't need for every single couple to have the capacity to reproduce. Indeed, I said couple, but there's, you see from the technology, there's absolutely no reason why you have to talk in those terms. It can be any individual. There's an individual desire for procreation, the societal issues that maybe that's not the best thing. How do we balance those things? Now, finally, there are issues that I think are related to justice. Issues of distributive justice are always there when you talk about a new technology. This is incredibly expensive stuff. In vitro fertilization, I think the last time I saw the statistic, cost an average of $20,000 a pop. And that's just a chance. Sometimes you go 3, 4, 5, 6 times, and you may or may not be successful. Should insurance pay for that? Which is to say, should we pay for everyone having a right to have that? We can assume that whenever genetic engineering becomes a possibility in a therapeutic nature, you know, where you go into the hospital to have a couple of genes straightened out, that's at least going to initially be a rather expensive process. Again, who pays for that? And the immediate thing is, of course, that this technology benefits those who have the money to pay for it. If it's so significant, should we make it available to the whole society? And again, who pays for that? Or to put it a different way, these technologies are incredibly expensive compared to childhood immunizations and ensuring adequate nutrition. They're incredibly expensive, and they benefit one person as opposed to a whole society. See, you can ensure adequate nutrition for every child in Harlem for the average cost of an in vitro fertilization. Or to put it in another question, you know, the Human Genome Project, is incredibly expensive. Our folks at Tech talk about it being the economic black hole for grant money these days. Folks who want to work on things other than the Human Genome Project, like immunology, for example, have a heck of a time getting funding for their stuff. How do we decide what is more valuable? It seems to me there's a real potential for social stratification based on this. You know, that we say some folks can afford to have designer jeans, hence the title, and other folks can't. And I would suggest to you that some of the exact same psychological dynamics begin to operate, you know? As if somebody was kidding around and said, we used to ask, you know, what's your sign, what's your birthday, and now we're going to be saying, what's your genes? You know, and there's certainly the potential of people talking about, well, it used to be a tummy tuck, well, you know, for a 22nd chromosome fix. What will we do when we have, some people have the capability of taking advantage of these technologies and others that don't? One final thing, and then we'll throw it open for discussion. I said in the very first lecture that technology has a way of having all kinds of connections. That if you pull over here, you may find something over here being affected. One of the other issues that's brought this genetic engineering to a forefront are some geneticists' great concern that the gene pool is being polluted. And by that, you see, it used to be, if you were a diabetic, you were likely not to live to the age of procreation. You know, now, there's no reason why one needs to die from diabetes. And so, henceforth, more and more persons will be born with that gene. Technology has also affected, the number one killer for most of human history was infectious disease, you see? And in our country, there's no reason why most people need to die of infectious disease unless it's simply a connector to something like AIDS. But, you know, we've got things. The technology has dealt with some very significant issues for us. But that means folks who were weaker now live to procreate. Now, some geneticists say this is a big brouhaha and it's not really going to happen. Others are deeply concerned about it. I'm not a geneticist and biologist and can't speak definitively on that. But I think it's those kinds of stories, those kinds of questions that are going to increasingly be posed to us. Well, if we're going to save people by our technology, to let them live longer, then we have a duty to sort of clean up the genetic pool lest we find ourselves in a very difficult situation. Okay, I think that's enough, and I know it's enough for me, my talking. I'd like to hear your comments, questions, reflections, whatever.
One thing I can think of is we are creating, perhaps, a Tower of Babel.
Okay, spin out that a little bit.
By relying on our, obviously we have to, relying on our self-efforts, ruling out perhaps the need for the spiritual base, because science and technology, information is proceeding at a fast pace, and all of a sudden we are powerful,
yes,
whether we are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't believe God zaps people, but he could sure zap a tower. He did once.
Well, I guess the thing that bothers me most about the Human Genome Project was, you know, the way it all started, and with the funding coming because they wanted to cure what was cystic fibrosis. Well, cystic fibrosis is a disease of the white you know, American, European descent people. It wasn't started because they were looking for a cure for sickle cell anemia. You know, and as it progresses, and that's what the plea was, for money and for funds. Well, you know, fewer people die in a year in the United States from cystic fibrosis than they do in one day from motor vehicle accidents or you know, other such things, whether it's cigarettes or alcoholism. And so we didn't start it so that we could find the genes to go down to El Salvador and cure an Indian disease down there. That's not how it was funded. That's not who gave the money, and that's not what's going to be done with it.
Yeah.
And then, which brings the whole question that you posed, is the access. How are, you know, we're not going to take this technology to inner city Chicago and give it to the people who come into Cook County Hospital. I mean, that's not who's going to get it, and they're not going to be able to benefit, because we're already at the stage, especially in Oregon, where we have allocated healthcare dollars. There are not healthcare dollars to give this technology to people. It just doesn't exist anymore. It used to, but it doesn't anymore. So what? It becomes almost academic to talk about it. If it does occur, I think it's going to be a relatively, you know, dangerous thing, especially when you're talking about SID. We can't decide on SID now, except for a few people who are trying to enlighten us, like Jesse Helms, that says, you know, AIDS
right.
has come to cure the sins of people who got it, you know.
Right.
And or the abortion issue, you know. I mean, that has been debating for, as long as I've been alive. Is it a sin or is it not a sin? And the grenades that are being thrown upon the clinics for that.
Yeah.
Well, we opened this can of worms.
Right.
You know, and now if we can't decide if something that's totally not genetic, which is abortion, and then we're trying to decide is something else a sin that is genetic. You know, we can't define sin medically now anyway, you know, in terms of abortion. I just don't know.
Yeah, and I'm not glad you brought up abortion, because if we think abortion is a hot potato now, wait till we have the potential for comprehensive genetic screening. And suddenly there's this, you have the knowledge, you know this is going to be a grotesquely deformative disease, you know, a variety of things. Talk about incredible pressure for therapeutic abortions.
Don't we already have that knowledge? I mean, there's a lot of things that you can already say. You know that there's an epidemic down.
Yeah. Yeah, right. You can do a little bit, but you know, it's we tend to do it for very specific kinds of things in a very limited case. But we're going to have the capability to control for things like a predisposition to heart disease. Now, what do you do with that? I mean, you know, that is so ubiquitous that we almost sort of think that is just something you deal with. But more and more we're finding, you know, that there's a strong genetic propensity for heart disease. That, you know, some folks can sit there and feast on pork and butter their whole life, never develop. Other people can be lean and keen and jog every day and are still going to get it. What happens when we have the knowledge? You know, and maybe more importantly, would you want to know? Would you really like to know that you were destined for Alzheimer's?
No. What kind of a life would you have then?
Yeah.
Free.
Well, yeah. And some people make a very strong distinction that we should not do screening unless we have therapeutic capabilities. That is, we don't tell people they've got Alzheimer's until we've got a way to therapeutically, either genetically fix it or medically fix the thing.
Huntington's, we're already there. Obviously, with Huntington's, that's one case where we're already there. I mean, you're offered the choice. You can find out or not.
Right.
Well, yeah, that's the key point. I think he phrased it, should be told. And I think the more proper question is, should I ask, not should I be told?
Right. Yeah. And then the other thing, and this I alluded to the insurance companies. Of course, you know, the whole premise of insurance is actuarial, spreading the risk around. All right, suppose we have the capability for this. do we require people to have screening? You know, we do this in a very basic sort of way. When people get married, in some states, we require a blood test. You know, it is already there, the precedent for screening before, you know, well, obviously that doesn't ensure procreation, or you can procreate outside of marriage, obviously. But, you know, we already have that sort of precedent that we require a screening before we give the imprimatur that it's okay. So, you know, we have got this whole cluster of issues of confidentiality. Who is to be told? Suppose I have the screening, am I to be required to tell my son about his condition? Who's going to keep track of the data? Who's going to maintain security on it? And we're going to talk a little bit about that, about computers tomorrow, online community and so forth. But there's all those confidentiality issues that are related to the genetic engineering. Other comments? Yeah.
To me, it seems like this is boiling down to technology being used to improve people's lives or people's chances of survival and things like that. I would have to argue that we're already using technology for our survival. I mean, personally, I would love to be able to drink the water outside, and I'm not even fit to drink that water. Water at Golden Village, I cannot drink because it would be parasitic. I would also like to be able to stand outside in the sun for extended periods of time without getting burned or something like that. Not fit to do that either. I don't know whether it's right or not, but that's something that I would like to be able to do. And that just raises other issues as to if that's what you want to do, and you have the capability to do it, should you?
Yeah.
I'd like to comment on that. A couple of things that have been said is I look at this as a very promising development in terms of what we can do with genetics. I think the limit is going to be economic, but we are already facing that limit in that we don't have the funds to take care of all the people. The government is now going to decide whether we're going to take care of poor people or old people because we can't afford to take care of both. And so we're already faced with the economic dilemma even before genetic engineering came into the picture. And so whether you're going to be able to do something about your getting sunburned will depend on whether you have the economic ability to do it. That may not be fair, but it's not bad. It just may not be fair that some people are going to have the opportunity to do that and other people are. That doesn't mean that technology is bad, though. I don't think we should condemn a technology because people can't afford it. I think that all of these issues are already present with us, and I'm aware of people who do sex selection based on amniocentesis. They don't want baby girls, so they have an abortion after their amniocentesis. I mean, to me, is that any different than finding out that my baby is going to have a predisposition for heart disease, and therefore making a choice like that? To me, we're already facing those decisions. So I think that the ethical problems are right before us right now, as are the economic ones, and they're just going to get bigger with what we can do with genes now, which is going to be very expensive.